Back at it midweek, Wednesday, October 28th, right here on Connecticut Today. We talk with a representative, a constitutional lawyer from the Pacific Legal Foundation, about her thoughts concerning the possible impact of now Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett on the high court in the years to come, and also on some legal cases as well. In the 4 o'clock hour, one of the state's leading economic voices, Dr. Fred Carstensen of UConn, talked about his new report that says it'll take the state about 10 years to fully recover economically from previous problems coupled with the coronavirus pandemic. Sitting on the high court, joining us to chat about that is senior attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation, Anastasia Bowden, joins us to chat about that for a while. Anastasia, hi. Paul here on WICC in Bridgeport. How are you?
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm very well.
Well, let's talk about a couple of things here. First, before we get to the whole court packing thing and how that would work, if that's even possible, your thoughts on the confirmation of now Justice Barrett and what impact she might have on the high court. And now there are people, Anastasia, you'll probably see this saying, okay, will there be a realignment on the court? Will John Roberts now shift to the liberal side of this, all the chess pieces moving here? What are your thoughts on those ideas?
Yeah, at a general level, it's just really unfortunate to see the politicization of the court. And I think it reflects a deep misunderstanding about how judges operate. And it conflates judicial philosophy, the act of judicial interpretation, the role of judges with pure partisan politics. And it's an unfortunate perception that doesn't play out in real life, because you do often see surprising outcomes on the courts where justices surprise you or they align with other justices that you wouldn't expect. And I think because of that politicization, it's going to take us a while to see how Justice Barrett affects the court, because it's hard to separate right now what's true from what's being said, because so many people are, you know, using hyperbole to say that it's the end of the world because they don't like a few decisions they expect her to make. And so it all sort of now becomes difficult to separate truth from reality. But in general, I think we can expect her to be, you know, we know she said that she's an originalist. She was a clerk for Justice Scalia. So I think you can expect her to follow along those lines, but you never know. She's outspoken, and she certainly has her own opinion on things. So it mostly remains to be seen.
And I have mentioned, Anastasia, and, you know, you can go back through history, as you alluded to, and you have these justices that are, you know, supposedly going to be conservative rubber stamps or leftist liberal rubber stamps. And as you say, we are often surprised by how they view cases. So a judge's previous decisions and previous opinions aren't always a roadmap to how they may think on certain issues.
That's exactly right. We've seen that in the past going, you know, as Justice Blackmun, for example, is a famous example in recent years, Justice Souter. So you don't really know. But that being said, even though you can predict, you can usually predict with some certainty that, let's say, justices who follow an originalist understanding of the Constitution tend to stick more closely to the text of the Constitution. And because the Constitution is a liberty-protecting document, you get decisions that are more favorable towards individual liberties. Even though you can sort of predict general trends, that is not synonymous, again, with purely partisan politics. And so even though it's not surprising that certain political parties tend to favor certain justices, it doesn't mean that they will align on every single decision. And so, I think it's exactly what you said, that there's this misunderstanding of what's going on, and it's really delegitimizing the integrity of the court.
Anastasia Bowden is the guest. Anastasia, hang on. We'll be right back with you, getting more of a look here at the possible impact of now Justice Amy Coney Barrett on the U.S. Supreme Court. More with attorney Anastasia Bowden, senior attorney, the Pacific Legal Foundation, after we do traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And we spend a couple more minutes with the senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, Anastasia Bowden. Joining us, Anastasia, we've been hearing now a lot of euphemisms over the past few days They're trying to get away from the term packing the court or adding justices. Some of my favorites have been rebalancing. That's one I've seen. There's others floating around out there, of course, like rebalancing, like political realignment. That's another one I've seen. But we all know what they're talking about. Explain to my listeners here, if there are forces in a coming Biden administration and in Congress who say, listen, we're upset, there are too many conservative justices on the high court, we're going to try and do what FDR did and got smacked back during the Depression days, how would they go about doing this or trying to add justices?
Yeah, well, the really interesting thing is there is no limit on Congress's ability to court pack. That is, the Constitution says nothing about the size of the Supreme Court. It establishes the Supreme Court, but it leaves it to Congress to say how many justices there are. And historically, Congress has done that throughout history, although for, 100 years now or so, it stayed at about 9. And the reason why you're seeing people trying to start to relabel the term is because they understand that it stayed 100, it stayed, 9 for the past 100 years. For very good reason, is that people understand that it's a bad idea to court pack, and that FDR's plan was defeated. Ruth Bader Ginsburg herself said it was a bad idea when FDR introduced it. It's a bad idea now. She thought 9 was a very good number, and so because history has shown it to be a bad idea, and historically it's been disfavored, they're now trying to relabel what they're doing. But there's no doubt about it. They're trying to add seats to the bench in order to change the ideological composition and to get different results than what they think would happen now. And unfortunately, there's really no barrier to that, except for if the populace, calls up their representatives and says, we don't want this. The only barrier is the political pressure that constituents can put on their representatives.
Do people, Anastasia, really understand, do you think, the gravity of what that would do? You're talking about one of the three chambers of government, the three levels, the independent levels of government we have, which, as you say, the Supreme Court number, it did fluctuate a few times, but for the past 150 years, it has not been changed with good reason. Again, I know that FDR tried, and it pretty much reinvigorated the conservative movement when he tried to do it. Do you think the average person understands the gravity of this or not?
I don't think so, because I think we're in this age of hyper-partisanship where people they're just outcome-oriented, and that's very unfortunate because the judiciary exists to be an apolitical branch of government. It's supposed to be a check on the legislative branch. It's supposed to be independent. If justices are just there to rubber stamp whatever political party they favor, there is no meaningful check on government power, because the legislature now can do whatever it wants to do because it knows the judiciary is just going to go along with it. And that's really dangerous to our system of government and our Constitution and ultimately our individual liberties.
The high court is likely to hear now a case or two, Anastasia, regarding the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. It's one aspect of the act, but I get calls on this show, our morning show host, our midday host here. They all get calls saying, "Oh my God, the Supreme Court is going to destroy my health care. They're going to take all the health care from all these Americans." That's not necessarily the case, is it? They're being asked to look, and correct me if I'm wrong here, please. They're being asked to look at a specific point about the Affordable Care Act, correct?
That's absolutely right. And in fact, they're being asked to consider whether the individual mandate, which requires people to obtain health insurance or to pay a fee, is constitutional. And the fact of the matter is, right now, Congress recently reduced the fee to zero. So the mandate's doing nothing. There's no penalty for flouting it. It's essentially, a nothing burger, a nullity. It exists, but you don't even have to obey by it. You wouldn't suffer if you didn't. And so I think, there is a question of severability. That is, the court will also answer whether, if the mandate goes, is it so fundamentally connected to the rest of the Affordable Care Act that the whole thing has to go. But it's my perception that no constitutional scholar thinks that's going to happen. Most people think, if anything, the mandate will go down, but it's pretty irrelevant at this point, and that the court would not reach and strike the entire Affordable Care Act down. I think that's being used again to once again politicize our court and to fearmonger and to, you know, scare people into advocating for or against particular justices. But it is at least my perception that this really only pertains to the mandate and isn't a serious threat to the rest of the Affordable Care Act.
So by that, Anastasia, by that theory of severability, then the justices could come out and say, listen, we don't want to throw millions of people into the street without health care, but Congress, you've got to, what, go back and fix this, amend this, better define this, add a dollar figure to it, whatever. But this specific part, like you fix a part on a car, that's got to get tweaked. Am I correct here?
Yeah, that's right. The court would just single out the mandate and say, hey, Congress can't do this. This is beyond Congress's power. And in fact, it really already said that, you know, almost 10 years ago when the court before considered the individual mandate, it upheld the mandate as a tax, but it said that Congress could not impose it if it were just a straight mandate. And now that the penalty's gone, now that it's $0, it's not really a tax anymore. It's just a straight mandate. So none of this should be surprising to anyone that it is beyond Congress's power to force people to get health insurance if it doesn't structure it as a tax. Because the Supreme Court said that 10 years ago. So none of this is surprising. The Supreme Court can go in and just excise out that mandate, leave the rest of the Affordable Care Act intact, and, you know, life will go on. As a constitutional lawyer, I'm constantly surprised that people think, you know, each Supreme Court decision is going to be the end of the world. But in reality, the court moves pretty slowly, pretty marginally. And most of the cases are actually very mundane. I mean, I love the court, but I'm just saying, as most cases are. And so life will go on for all of us.
All right. Thank you. Senior Attorney Anastasia Bowden. She's at the Pacific Legal Foundation. Folks, check them out. They do a lot of work with property rights and the Constitution. A lot of it is pro bono as well. Pacific Legal Foundation. Check them out online. Anastasia, thank you. We appreciate it. Good luck. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Check them out, folks. Pacific Legal Foundation. That's the senior attorney there, Anastasia Bowden, who herself says, she is a constitutional lawyer, so she gets it. And again, this is part of the message. You know, calm down about if you're on the Affordable Care Act and everybody's afraid that people are going to be dumped in the street without health care. That's likely not going to happen. Could it happen? I guess. Do you think 9 justices are all going to sit around a table in their chambers when they have to vote and say, okay, we're going to vote to throw millions of people off health care? Do you really think they're going to do that? Or might they say, in a clearer world, okay, the act can stay, but this is a little squishy. Congress has to do its job and fix this. Because a majority of us, 5-4, 6-3, 7-2, say, okay, yeah, kind of overstepped your bounds a little here. We're doing our job, looking at this law, saying, this is okay, this is okay, this isn't. So this notion that we're hearing about, oh my God, millions of people are going to die, that's irresponsible. You know, it's like, honestly, you remember the argument we had, when was it? 2 years ago or so, when net neutrality, remember that? There was, the whole net neutrality argument that was going around, and the Republican leader of Ajit Pai, who I think still leads the FCC, they were going to strike down some of the net neutrality regulations, which at the time said that all internet traffic had to be treated equally, and some of the telecoms said, well, no, if some guy is hogging all this bandwidth on the street and it's screwing up our service, we have the capacity to slow people down. Remember that whole thing about net neutrality? You know, I had friends of mine, literally asking me on social media, you know, a private message saying, listen, this net neutrality thing, you know, my kids are freaking out that their cell phones aren't going to work, that the FCC is going to turn off the internet. I'm like, no, the internet's not going anywhere. Their speeds may be a little different, but the internet's not going anywhere. Oh, my God, we look at the worst possible outcomes. Our next guest is a professor of finance and economics at UConn. He directs the Connecticut Center for Economic Analysis at the UConn School of Business. I've talked to him numerous times over the years. We welcome back Dr. Fred Carstensen with us. Fred, Paul Pacelli, it's been a few years. How are you, sir?
I'm doing pretty well, thank you.
Hey, Fred, so you came out with this report. You co-authored this report a few days ago, laid it out, and it looks like, Fred, correct me if I'm wrong, is this kind of a long slog coming up or a slow process to get back to pre-COVID levels? Tell my listeners what we're looking at here.
Well, it's gonna be a long and difficult recovery. The first thing that people really have to understand is Connecticut was in deep trouble before the pandemic. We had never recovered from the Great Recession. And in fact, we've had virtually no job creation or population growth. And of course, the two are connected since 1989. We've had almost 30 years without really much in the way of job creation. Now, this was masked between 97 and 2007. We had an extraordinarily powerful growth in the value of output in Connecticut. It was perhaps the fastest growing state in the nation during that period. And then after 2008, we just started going backwards. We actually shrank in our state economy for about 7 years. And people say, how did that happen? We started adding jobs in 2010. Well, the jobs we were adding paid less than $40,000 for the most part. The jobs we were losing paid more than $80,000. So we're adding jobs. We're adding low-quality jobs, tourism, hospitality in particular, some elder care. And we're losing jobs, particularly in finance and insurance. We've lost a quarter of our finance and insurance sector, pretty dramatic. And so we had a little bit of recovery after 2016. But in February of 2020, before the pandemic shutdowns, we were still about 6% smaller than we had been in 2008. No other state suffered that kind of fate. And it's especially odd because our immediate neighboring states, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New York, actually all had pretty robust recoveries. So we were going in the wrong direction before the pandemic hit. And then the pandemic, we lost almost 300,000 jobs. Nearly a quarter of those were actually in tourism and hospitality because that was the most vulnerable sector. That's, you know, restaurants, hotels, tourism. We have some very, very fine tourism sites, the Essex Steam Train, the aquarium. And so we have a couple of very good aquariums in Connecticut. We're going to struggle to recover. And if we don't change the kinds of things that we do in Connecticut, if we don't adopt some new policies, our pessimistic forecast says we may not recover until 2030. We might be in 10 years of no recovery.
Wow.
With very large state deficits, a lot of cuts to state services, a lot of cuts to municipal aid. Now, I want to emphasize, this is very important.
Sure.
This is what might be. This is not what will be. This is where we are likely headed if we don't change how we are doing things in Connecticut. Now, we have not in Connecticut had a serious attention to economic development, literally, in 30 years. I mean, I've been running the center now for 22 years, and we have never had a serious discussion in the legislature. I've done three dozen of these forecasts. Normally, our forecasts are short-term, 10 quarters, 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time we've done a 10-year. But the legislature has never invited me to come in and simply lay out how are we doing as a state economy. Not a policy preference, nothing about sort of where you should go, Democrat or Republican, but simply how are we doing? So the legislature has never given serious, sustained attention to economic development. My last point is that the analogy, people always ask why. Well, of course, there are a lot of different factors that come into this. But the primary factor is there's something very happened in 1993. It's called the World Wide Web and Amazon. And the infrastructure for that, the IT infrastructure, is enormously crucial. Except Connecticut doesn't have any to speak of. So think about this. If I-84 and I-95 went through Connecticut without a single off-ramp, without a single entrance, and we had to drive to New York on, you know, US 1, going through every, you know, coastal community in Connecticut.
Yeah.
If we had to go to Boston on back roads, that's basically where we are. And I have done very careful granular analysis of occupational characteristics in Connecticut. We're just absent. Rhode Island, in the occupations connected to the IT, grew 10 times faster
wow.
than Connecticut. 10 times faster.
Fred, hang on. Fred, do me a favor. Just hang on a minute. I want to get into this more because this is fascinating. I never knew we were that behind here. Just a quick break. Dr. Fred Carstensen is the guest. Fred, hang on. Of course, Fred from the School of Business, University of Connecticut. He directs the Connecticut Center for Economic Analysis. Back with more from Dr. Fred Carstensen after Traffic and Weather together here on WICC. Couple of more minutes here with Dr. Fred Carstensen from the University of Connecticut. So, Fred, fascinating point you brought up. I want to go back to that. You say that Connecticut, going back to the origins of the internet, back in 1993, early 90s, of course, we all remember that well, we still don't have the technological backbone to take advantage of all this? Talk a little more about that.
Yes, that's exactly the case. Think about what's been going on in the world. We've got an incredibly intensive reliance on the internet and a huge volume of data. Let's just talk about a very important Connecticut company, Otis Elevator. Every Otis Elevator and every Otis Escalator has multiple sensors on it that collect real-time data immediately and is transmitted to Otis. So literally every single day, Otis collects exabytes of data, and they can analyze that and they track it, and they know whether your escalator needs service before you do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so these companies are becoming service companies. Where are they going to store all that data? They have to have a very large data center. You have to have a large physical capacity. You know, we call it the cloud, but the cloud is not in the cloud. The cloud is literally a building with
yeah.
a bunch of servers.
Yeah.
And Connecticut, we have only 17 data centers. They're all relatively small. I once added them all up in terms of square footage, which is a good proxy for their capacity. The aggregate of all 17 together was smaller than the single largest data center in Boston. There was an industry study about a year ago, which highlighted that the Northeast, in fact, is fairly rich in data centers, except for this one odd anomaly, which is called Connecticut. We just weren't there.
Do we need to become, Fred, do we need to become a Silicon Valley? Would that work?
Well, we're not going to become a Silicon Valley, but in fact, we have enormous competitive advantage on being a location for hyperscale cloud data centers. And that's because we are very close to Boston and New York, which both have enormous demand for capacity. And we have, the reason it's spatial advantage is there's a thing called latency, which is the speed with which you can transmit information. And it turns out it's hard to actually transmit a lot of information quickly. IBM discovered this. They had very fast computers, and they discovered the computers were sitting idle a good chunk of time. Because getting the data on which they're going to do the computations in and out, the I/O as it's called, turns out to be about one-third of the speed at which you can actually process it. So you want this physical proximity. Well, Connecticut has this extraordinarily competitive latency with New York and Boston. So we know, because I know that major cloud providers, internet infrastructure providers, which is a sector, incidentally, that's growing about 40% a year. I mean, this is enormous growth. They've looked at Connecticut, but we don't offer the same kind of support that 31 other states offer, have a very specific structure to incentivize the development of data centers, because they're so crucial for how you're developing. The legislature actually has in front of it right now on the speaker's desk is a proposal that would make Connecticut competitive. And there are in our report, we went out of the way to list almost a dozen strategies that Connecticut could pursue that would clearly have material benefit, shorter term, longer term, depending on which ones we're talking about, and they would bend the curve. Right now, if we don't intervene, if we don't adopt policies and strategies that are going to change our competitive position, we're going to go down this path of, I sometimes make the analogy, we look like the Florida of the Northeast. We do tourism, hospitality, and logistics centers, and elder care. These are not growth strategies. We need to be moved back into, you know, we were the heart of the American Industrial Revolution. For a long time, Connecticut had a higher per capita patent rate than any other place, not only in the United States, but in the world.
That's amazing.
We were really the heart, and we were an enormously successful state up until 1990. We got crushed in the early 90s. We had the largest proportionate loss of jobs in that recession, 164,000 jobs, 10% of our labor force. And then in the 90s, we were actually beginning to lose touch with the modern economy. And the modern economy is data-driven, digitally dependent. And we were losing touch with that economy. But we were very successful with our old industries and, you know, with our heavy manufacturing, with our non-durable manufacturing, particularly pharma. We had insurance. Stuff, the older one, which was not the data intensive stuff.
So
and
we
what
were
happened after.
So Fred, we were stuck in that land of steady habits, that old New England, hey, it's working, don't bother me with new stuff ideas.
Exactly. Well, and it's very analogous to some very famous companies that have disappeared because they were enormously successful for a very long time. And they just didn't see what was coming down the pike. And Connecticut was like that. We were very successful. We didn't have to worry about what was happening because we were just very successful. Well, the world changed on us, and we failed to adjust. Now, we can adjust. We can redefine our future. But we're not going to do that with the simple-minded, oh, well, we're going to make some adjustments to our taxes and our regulatory environment and stuff. No, that is not going to get us anywhere. We need to take some very discreet actions, and we list them, as I said, in our analysis. It's on the ccea.ucon.edu website. We list things like the potential at Sikorsky Airport. Sikorsky is an enormously underutilized airport. It has the capacity. We know that for a fairly small investment, it could pull a lot of additional business in. There's a lot of activity that could be relocated and would relocate from Teterboro, for instance, because it's too crowded over there. And Sikorsky would be a better location. But Sikorsky only has really one runway right now. The FAA has put $13 million on the table to rehab the second runway. There's a real interest in improving the infrastructure there. There's no terminal there. That was taken out a number of years ago. We could reestablish that as a significant corporate private
Common
airport.
Sense.
We could actually regional. It would actually help Yale New Haven. Medical tourism is extremely important. We actually worked with the FAA some years ago on the potential at Tweed. The Tweed is enormously constrained. Sikorsky actually has the same acreage as LaGuardia.
Wow, that's amazing. Fred, I am short on time. I'm going to post this report so people can read it. Dr. Fred Carstensen, professor of finance and economics, directs the Connecticut Center for Economic Analysis. He says we better get on the horse here and catch up as quickly as we can. Fred, good to talk to you again. We'll chat down the road. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Fred Carstensen. About that, huh? There you go. He says we're behind and it ain't getting better.